Conference Committee on... Richard, would you please sit down and behave yourself? Thank you. The Conference Committee on Senate Bill 782 is in order, and we will open a work session. And we're going to hear some amendments, but first of all, Lynn Reed, would you come up, please? And Dr. Goldberg, would you come up? We want to clarify some of the language that is not amended, just to be sure that we are on firm ground for the 6-month grace period. Now, did you want to talk about that? Do you want to talk about that?
Just briefly, and then I'll let them describe in detail. Again, 782 did start in the Senate Human Service Committee. The bill does maintain the provision that came from the Senate, in which it requires the Department of Human Services to inform recipients who are let go of the program that they are eligible. The House did add a couple more provisions to this bill, one being that it would exempt people in the 0 to 10% of federal poverty level from having to pay premiums. That's for just OHP standard clients. It also would give OHP standard recipients a 6-month grace period. We did have to make amendments to that 6-month grace period provision per request from DHS to clarify what that exactly means. I will defer to our presenters. Those are the B7 amendments.
Okay.
We do have also the B-B8 amendments. I'll hand these out. They do the same thing as what I just described, except it does take out the exemption of people from 0 to 10%. So it does leave in the original provision that requires DHS to notify people, and it also fixes the 6-month grace period, except it would delete the 0 to 10% exemption. Those are the -B8 cell handout now. And one more set of amendments, and I will have to probably defer to Representative Dalton on these. We do also have the -B9 amendment, and I've just received these, so I don't have a lot of information on them. I'll defer to Representative Dalton, perhaps, to describe them.
Better now? They're not my amendments.
Okay, let's do the -B7 amendments first.
Lynn Reed, Interim Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. The -B7 amendments were important, we thought, to administer the provisions of the B-engrossed bill, and that was to make it clear that the 6-month grace period, it would be up to 6 months. It would basically allow us to administer a grace period that is similar to what we had prior to the changes that were made back in 2003. And so a person would, although owing premiums during the course of their 6-month certification period, they would not be disqualified for non-payment of premiums, but at the time that they came up to reapply again for a second 6-month period of eligibility, they would need to make payment on any arrearages. And so our interpretation of this is that we would allow that grace period up to the time that it's time to recertify again. And at that point, the individual would need to make payment in order to be found eligible again.
Okay. Sure.
Yes. People, when they're dealing with property taxes, they can be in arrears so far, and they will get to that point and then just pay monthly to keep from reaching the break point. Is that the way this is set up, or at the reapplication they have to come current? Which is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, it would be our expectation that we'd be able to write administrative rules that would basically say that it wouldn't be a month to month are you eligible. It would be for a certification period.
Right.
And need to make payment then.
Okay. My follow-up would be, because we're dealing with a 6-month period here, and So they come up to recertification and they pay a month and they're no longer 6 months in arrears. They're 5 months in arrears, and then they go another 6 months, and then they're 11 months. So I guess what I want on the record is that they, at reapplication, they would have to come current.
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, this is now designed to do exactly that, that you have a six-month period to make 6 months of payment. And if you don't pay month one and don't pay month two, 4 months later you have to have paid month one and month two, even if you've paid then month three, four, and five. You have a six-month window to make 6 months. You're responsible for 6 months of payment. Does that make it...
Identify yourself.
My apologies. Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Office of Health Policy.
Okay. One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. And I'm probably overcomplicating this, but this is something new here. Okay. Somebody has made their first 5 months payments on time. The 6 month, for some reason, they can't make a payment, and then they come up for re-eligibility. They're going to have to make that payment before they can reapply. Because that, I would say, we're having grace period here, but you get here and there's no grace period. Is that kind of the way it's going to work? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, we envisioned implementing this like the program used to be, and in fact, we would allow a grace related to that 6 month. If they had paid the first 5 months of premiums for the 6 month period, we'd go ahead and recertify them, even though they hadn't yet made their 6 month payment. And that's the way the program used to work.
Okay. But during the next six-month period, they would have to pay that six... They would, in essence, make a six-month payment.
Right.
They'd have to pay that 6 months plus the next 5 months. Mm-hmm. It would only be that first six-month period where you would only have to make 5 months of premium payment.
Okay.
But that makes sense.
That does make sense. Thank you. Okay. Just wanted to get it clear.
So we've spent a lot of time going through this ourselves,
okay,
to be clear.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, by way of clarification,
yes,
I made
Representative.
So Dr. Goldberg, it is potential that a plan recipient could, in fact, be 11 months in arrears and still be certified.
Chair Morissette and Representative Dalto, no, they could at max only be 1 month. When you go to recertify, you have a six-month period. At the end of that six-month period, you need to pay those 6 months, at least five of those 6 months, to recertify. You could never be 11 months.
So you could be 7 months, though.
You could be at max yes, you could be 7 months.
Thank you.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
If I could, so we're still on the B7s, right? Okay. A lot of the B's are... A portion of the B7s deal with a bill that we dealt with in the Senate and didn't move, dealing with the premiums for 10% federal poverty. Your predecessor, Barney Spate, said that it, although in concept it was laudable, it may indeed create more problems than it would solve. And basically, for those reasons, we didn't move it. Why is it suddenly better?
Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Yes.
I thought we did move it to budget. Mr. Bacovian, do you remember?
So, Chair Morissette and Senate Bill 824, we can reference to the... Originally, Senate Bill 824 did have this provision in it. This came out of Senate Health Policy Committee. It was passed out of committee and was sent to Senate Budget Committee.
Yes, exactly.
Well, for a specific reason, but I was assuming. So my question is, if it needed to go to a Budget Committee, why is it here?
There were reasons why... We have a fiscal, right, on it?
Yes, I could speak to the fiscal if you'd like.
Yes, if you would, please.
There was a fiscal on the bill, and what we've looked at is that this bill would have exempting individuals with income below 10% of the poverty. Means there would be some premium revenue that we would no longer collect. And likewise, having a grace period for those of higher income, there would be some premium revenue that would likely not be paid. Our fiscal, however, assumes that although that premium revenue is gone, that we operate within a budget box for this program of provider tax premiums and federal matching funds, and that we could accommodate this by serving fewer people in the program. And the fiscal assumes that for those below 10% of poverty, that lost premium represents about 300 people served in the program, and a similar amount above poverty, or above 10% of poverty.
Which was my point. You know, if that's the unintended consequence, is we eliminate this premium, and you know, I mean, we've already skinnied standard down to the point of almost non-existence, and by doing this, we're cutting more people off, and I'm, you know, as a public policy, I'm just not sure that's an appropriate thing for us to be doing. Is Mr. Chair is. It was my objection at the time, and still is.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify what I think I heard the department saying, which was that, A, the department could accommodate this given the current program structure, and that that there is, in effect, a fiscal in so much as the department could manage with this expense as they continue on their glide down on the Oregon Health Plan standard number. So, in other words, the department can absorb this internally. And two, my question is, are you in fact collecting any premium from this 0 to 10% population anyway?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, you are correct that we believe that we could absorb this by taking that glide path in terms of reducing the number of eligible served in the program down a little bit lower than otherwise. In terms of collecting premium, yes, we are collecting premium, and one of the reasons for that is that there are sponsors who have stepped up, community sponsors, who have made sure that people below 10% of the poverty do not lose eligibility. If they're in danger of losing eligibility, the sponsors have provided payment for their premium.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes,
follow-up. So, I mean, is it even are we even certain that people are going to lose these slots? I mean, I think the agency could probably absorb this without losing those 200 or 300 positions that people are concerned about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, certainly we do have to operate within the budget box. There is no general fund for this program. So the question will be, it's a bit unknown in the sense that we don't know exactly what the expenditures are going to be during the next two-year period. It's possible if the cost per person is a little bit less than what we have estimated, that indeed we would be serving the same number of people. But right now our estimates would indicate that we're likely to have to serve some fewer number of people in the program.
If I might just interject a comment, I think the policy choice here is how we lose people. That we have either way, whether we have a policy that exempts people and we bring down the number to a few more people, we lose people in that way from people that we've been able to serve. When we've had a premium policy that's required those below 10% who have mental illness, have difficulties making that premium payment, we've lost a lot of those individuals as well. I mean, that's been the group that we've lost the most people from. And I think the policy choice that we're making is where we lose people, whether we lose people who are indeed the poorest of the poor, or we put in policies in place to continue to serve the poorest of the poor and lose some of the folks who have incomes up above that. That's really the policy choice that we're wrestling with, because what we've seen is that it's that group between 0 and 10% that had the greatest inability and the greatest loss in terms of paying the premium, and those are the individuals who fell off.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. Just to follow up, so to be clear, first of all, that 0 to 10% population, where does that fall on the federal poverty level on an annual level?
Oh, my daughter gave you a chart.
I know the answer to the question I've already asked. Let's put it that way. But I'd like you to answer.
Sure.
0 to 10%, I think.
So it's around $70 a month.
Yeah, about 80. That. It's going to take me a minute to pull up the file.
Well, Dr. Goldberg is doing the calculation or looking up the information. I will also comment that most of the people below 10% of the poverty level are actually at 0% of the poverty level.
Income. Yeah. So which leads me to my other point, by the way, this business about losing people. I'm not convinced that we're actually losing people. We're just closing the enrollment as we go down so they can't reapply. So I just want to have you make clear that we're not kicking anybody out of this program. We're not saying you got to go because we're not collecting premium. We're saying, you know, we have this trajectory on the OS, Oregon Health Plan standard population, and we're going to take it down a little bit more. But we're not kicking anybody off the program.
That's attrition, man.
Through attrition.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalton, that's absolutely correct.
Get that number?
No, I'm having
$1,000
an electronic failure.
Less than $1,000. Okay. I'll give you an abacus, I think.
That's what I need.
Okay. Other discussion.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Cruz.
Number one, the 0 to 10 are probably the most likely to be sponsored. Number two, I mean, you can play the numbers any way you want. We're dealing with a finite set of we're dealing with a finite budget, and if you are reducing revenue into that budget, you are reducing the budget, and you know it's got to come out of somewhere, and it may be through attrition, and that may very well be, but the fact is that the numbers in some other part of the system will be decreased, and I just Mr. Chair, to say that somebody 0 to 10 has greater need than somebody 30 to 40 is speculative at best, I would say. To a degree, if you're below 50% federal poverty, you're poor. Okay, pure and simple. Whether you're that is poor. And to a degree, we are prejudicing the system by doing this. It's amazing the ways people find to be innovative to get their needs covered. We have, in the last few years, we have discontinued some programs, some drug assistance programs, and some other things, and a whole bunch of those people found other ways to get their needs filled. Not everybody, but a significant number of them. So I guess I'm just not sure. I mean, this sounds like a good idea, but I think as a matter of public policy, when we instituted the premiums in 2001, we did it in a very deliberative way. And we did it for a very deliberative purpose, and I think it is a little too soon to be abandoning the premise under which we did that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. I'm interested in the trajectory and the attrition that we're talking about, potentially in excess of 300 individuals to be serviced here. My concern is what is the current workload? What is the trajectory? What period of time will those 300 plus individuals potentially have gone off the program anyway?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we had anticipated over a year ago that we would be at around 24,000 people today. Actually, we're not. We're above that level, and so we are still continuing the trajectory downward. The budget is currently built on an assumption that we can serve about 24,000 individuals. We do believe that... However, since there is still a downward trend, that we will actually level off where the average number of individuals being served in the program would be around, for the biennium, would be around, almost serendipitously, 23,300, I think, which would allow for the 600, that natural downward trend would do that.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so a 600 downward trend for the biennium, which would mean about 300 per year. So we're anticipating, are we anticipating about 300 per year? Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no, we're actually sitting up at about 27,000 right now. So we need to drop 3,000 plus the additional eligibles here. But it looks like just the natural attrition from the program would accomplish that without having to take a specific action.
So one more follow-up. I'm interested in the math here. We dropped from some number to 27,000 when we thought we would be at 24,000. I'm not sure how you're serving the extra 3,000. That's certainly about a 12 to 13% greater caseload than what you had anticipated within your budget box. So I'm anxious attempting to service people that we did not have the resources within the budget box to service, that we will place in jeopardy the entire program. And I need some satisfaction that I guess I'm not feeling good about the 27 versus the 24,000. That's a fairly hefty shift there. But if you're going to tell me that at this date in 2007, we're going to be down 3,000 plus individuals served, then I need to have some kind of a feel as to how you moved. You haven't made that kind of a move thus far. Why do you anticipate that that's going to be the move during this next 24 months?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we closed the program a year ago in July and processed all the applications that were in the pipeline. And so we started basically the attrition at about 55,000. And we've come down over an 11-month period to the 27,000. And we anticipate at the rate that we've been seeing the attrition continue, that indeed we will drop down. Actually, we'll drop below the 23,300 so that the average monthly that would be served during the 24-month period would come back into budget.
And that will be with the Dash 7 amendments?
With the Dash 7 amendments, we can achieve that population.
Without endangering this, that's what I need to know.
Right. And although it's still a bit of an unknown, this is based upon our experience to date and our current projections.
The 24,000 is an average monthly enrollment. So it depends where you start and where you end, and it's your average over the biennial period. We're prepared that if the attrition doesn't continue on a path that is sustainable by the amount of dollars, at that point there is an option to disenroll people if indeed the trajectory is not getting us to where we are. What we have done is continually monitor this to be certain that we do stay within an average budget box over the biennium, and at different times have to make decisions about whether we continue attrition or at that point say there are, we're never going to meet the target, and we have to disenroll people. And we'll have to do that regardless of what's done about the 10% premium issue.
Mr. Chair, if I can just express my concern, if we're at 27,000 now, and we're going to average 24,000 during this entire period, then we'd almost have to end up at 21,000 at the far end in order to average 24,000 for this entire 24-month period. My concern is, I'm not hearing 21,000, but my concern is it may endanger the program for all of the families that are involved if we misjudge the trajectory and overshoot the runway and are unable to land safely for all families involved in enrollment.
Now, what likelihood is there? I mean, there are some knowns, but is it possible that we could lose the program if we misjudge?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't anticipate that outcome. That what we would be doing is monitoring our progress towards having the appropriate number of eligibles that fit in the budget box, and that if necessary, we would take actions at appropriate decision points to make sure that we stay within that budget box.
Now, as far as the premiums being paid by organizations who go out and collect money and pay premiums, they do keep a percentage of what they collect, right?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of anyone keeping money that any of the organizations that are paying premiums keeping a portion of the money they collect, or are you talking about
clarify there. We had testimony that they take about a third of the money they collect. One or more of the organizations.
We do have a contract with a vendor to bill for premiums and to collect the premiums and to maintain the records. Their monthly charge per person is, I think, around $3.
Okay. Now, my question, though, really my question is that contract would not be affected if we eliminate the bottom 10% from premiums? Would they continue to collect premiums for other people?
Mr. Chair, actually, it's unknown what impact a change in the premium structure would have in terms of those below 10%. About 40% of the population is below 10%. It's the lowest premium paying group. Mm-hmm. However, it's a big volume of the premium collection process and billing process. The contract is up for renewal later this summer with the vendor. If they expect to have a reduced volume, it will bring up a question of whether or not they can meet their overhead and whether or not they would want to negotiate a higher fee per case, or it may raise the issue of should it be brought in-house.
I guess we talk about and back to Representative Butler's concerns, which are valid, because if we're basing arriving at a number on attrition, basically at this point in time, people opting out, and they're opting out for many reasons. They choose not to pay premiums, a whole lot of other reasons. So if we excuse a significant portion of these folks from premiums, they will not opt out because they won't have any reason to. And so that might actually exacerbate our ability to get down and force us to kick people off. So, I mean, there are two sides to this issue. It's not a cut-and-dried situation. And I still, Mr. Chair, I think we may be being a bit premature in going the direction that the House amendments to this bill took us.
Senator Cruz, I think you are correct in saying that there would be potentially less people that leave. I think the issue is who those people are and why they leave and whether or not those are the folks that we want to serve. If indeed some of those people are the sickest of the sick and the most vulnerable and who are going to be getting their care in other places in a disorganized manner anyway. The issue is, I think, where we want to serve them and how. Because eventually these are individuals which are going to get served. And I think that comes back to the policy question in front of us. We have seen attrition based on our policies both above and below 10%.
Mm-hmm.
We're continuing to see people come on and off the plan. The issue is, if we have these 20-some-odd thousand slots, who we want those 20,000 slots to serve. And that's really the policy question before us, and how do we assure that we use each and every one of those 20,000 slots to take care of the most vulnerable people. And it's very difficult for us to pick and choose. But the question is, how within the framework we're operating with can we set up a premium payment program so that we try and assure ourselves that we get at those people who have the most need and who we want to get care in an organized fashion instead of in a manner that's in the long run going to cost all of us more anyway.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess Bruce, I think you would have a hard time differentiating between somebody at 5% federal poverty and somebody at 15% federal poverty.
I agree. I absolutely agree that those cutoffs are arbitrary. I think that there's no way of getting this down to an exact way. I think the reason this has come up is because we know that when we took the arbitrary cutoffs of 0 to 10%, that it's that group that disproportionately fell off the health plan. And that those people above 10% were more able to afford the premiums.
Okay. Okay.
We've had this discussion a lot.
We've had this discussion before. Now, according to DHS, there are 9,226, or 39% of the OHB standard, enrolled below the 10% poverty. Of this amount, 8,242. Or 89% are reported at 0% of poverty, which means that they don't have money. I think this is a policy issue, and we've had this discussion. I personally feel that these are the most vulnerable people in our society, and that we should exempt them from paying a premium because they are the most vulnerable, and because there is a cost shift going on, and it will continue to be. And my main concern was whether or not this could be absorbed in the department, or if it would be sent to the graveyard of all bills and never to see the light of day. And that was what I expressed to my colleague Senator Cruz in my possible opposition to this, but I'm satisfied personally that you can handle it within the department. So I'd like to have a motion on this.
Mr. Chair.
Before you do that, start to get the
Okay. Let's talk about the next amendment group. What's our next amendment?
B9.
The Senator, you've had before you the -B9 amendment.
-B9.
And those are the same as the -B7. It includes the 0% exemption, the 6-month grace period, except it does include provisions, and you can call up the support for that on page 5 of the -B9 set. Charge the Department of Human Services to address the purchase of generic and brand name drugs, and I will defer to.
Okay. Bruce, would you mind stepping down for just a minute?
Not at all, but I just would like for the record that 10% of poverty is $75 a month, or $900 a year. I may be late, but I did get the answer, and it's not that I need an abacus, it's that we have good staff.
Lynn, I need you to stay, though.
For 10% of poverty.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. Richard, would you please...
This is the Senate bill.
Come up. Tom, did you want to testify? You don't... Now, so you want to talk about your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosasan with Johnson & Johnson. And our amendment is an attempt to address, I think, a strange situation with current law. Under current law, if a generic is available, the department will always fall and fault towards the generic. Sometimes you will find, and I don't know, you will find when a brand goes off patent, you will find that the brand for a certain period of time is actually cheaper than the generic. When a brand name goes off patent, there is a 6-month window, a period of exclusivity. FDA only allows one generic into the market. After that 6-month window, you will find other generic manufacturers entering the market. And what we're trying to do simply with the amendment is suggest that rather than default always to the generic brand, the department has the flexibility, if it is found that the brand is cheaper and it is economically feasible and it makes sense to use the brand, to use the brand. We have discussed this with the pharmacists, Mr. Tom Holt, Sean Miller, Gary Oxley, the institutional pharmacies, and I think from the get-go, and I think they had a very legitimate concern, is that unless you protect the dispensing pharmacy or pharmacist, that could create some untold problems and unintended problems that we would not otherwise like to face. And we've discussed the drafting of this with Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. I think she is comfortable with it, but I think Mr. Holt would like further clarification, at least on the record. That's it. I think, with all due respect to Reed, I talked to Barney State before he had left, and we originally came in with an amendment to 782, and I thought it was a simple idea to find out that it was not such a simple idea, and it would have directed the department to use the lesser cost drug, whether it be a brand or a generic. And it was more of a directive. And this simply is intended to afford the department the flexibility to use either the generic or the brand.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Lynn, have you had a chance to read the B-9s?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, although I don't have a copy of the B-9s, I did read another copy. I don't have one in front of me.
Section 10, sub 8 on page 5 is what they're talking about. And I'd like to get your... I mean, there is a budget note, I know that, but my sense is that this does basically the same thing, and I would just... Ms. Chair, what I'm after, I mean, what we want is a direction and flexibility.
Okay. No, wait a minute. I want to hear from Tom first.
Oh, okay.
And then I was going to ask you that question, but Tom just...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I think Richard's given you a fairly good summary of what the intent is here. Just to clarify one point that is why this issue raises concerns for us. Pharmacy doesn't have access to that pricing information prospectively. when the generic comes onto the market, the generic to the pharmacy for the pharmacy's acquisition cost is always cheaper. And our private payers basically require the pharmacies to change over to using the generic immediately. What Richard's referring to is that net of rebates, which are adjudicated or negotiated between the department and a manufacturer, it is theoretically possible that you could have a product at lesser net cost to the department. Our members don't have access to that information. It's proprietary between the department and the manufacturer. In some instances, as in conversations with Richard and Mr. Spate before he left, it was apparent that the department may not even know prospectively. This rebates take some time to adjudicate out, sometimes up to a year. That said, I mean, conceptually, you know, we've always said that we would prefer to help the department with cost savings. Our concerns here, and we really appreciate Mr. Kosestan's attempts to answer our concerns. We've seen this language, as I think everyone here at the table has, just in the last hour. Conceptually, what it does is permits the department to pay only for the brand. The concern we have is how we operationalize this. There's a potential audit exposure, which the language may address. I can't say 100%, but I'm comfortable that it does. But what happens after the fact, and the department has an absolute right to do this, we'll come back and audit pharmacies. And if they find a claim that was dispensed other than by the department's payment rules, the auditor will say, aha, we're going to take back that claim, and we're going to take back every claim like it 100%, not just the difference necessarily.
Okay, now, stop for just a minute. This is a budget note. Did you have some discussion in creating the budget note?
Mr. Chair,
were you involved?
We saw the budget note after it appeared, but if I recall correctly, what the budget note does is instruct the department to bring the stakeholders together, study the issue, and report back on how this, if there's savings and if there are, how it might be operationalized.
Okay. That's good.
And we have no problem with the budget note per se.
Stop. Ms. Reed, tell us about the budget note.
Mr. Chair, the budget note Mr. Spate did agree to, and the budget note indeed does, as Tom described, in terms of directing us to review the potential for savings in this situation, and to also look into the administrative issues to work with stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And so it was, and there was some discussion in the budget subcommittees about then what happens. Mm-hmm. And in that discussion, it was thought that if indeed we found that this would be cost effective, the expectation would be that we would come back to an emergency board meeting and it would be a part of identifying a savings in our program expenditures in that interaction. And so that's what we were anticipating beginning that process. Through the budget note.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's all well and good, but studying things is wonderful, and we study the hell out of things in this building and buildings around it, but when I look at sub 8 of section 10, I mean, what you're saying, Lynn, is, you know, we'll study it, and if we think we can save money, we'll ask the e-board for it. This amendment allows you to go ahead and get the savings. And you know, so you've got a budget note that says go ahead and study this thing, and with sub 8 here, it says, and if there are savings, we can take them. And so I'm wondering why. I mean, don't you, with the budget note and this particular amendment, have the best of both worlds? It doesn't, you know, it's permissive language. It doesn't require you to do anything. It just gives you the ability to do it if you're going to save money. That's the way I'm reading it. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I'm reading it in that fashion as well, and that a part of studying this before we would move forward to implement it would be looking at the administrative issues and making sure this is something that works.
Ms. Chair, which I think is totally appropriate, but I think the import here is this would save you a step. You're not going to have to wait for an e-board. You know, you would be able to, you know, if the administration... You know, if all the stars line up, you can go ahead and do it because you now have statutory authority to do so with this amendment. So, am I reading it wrong, Tom? Or
well, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I think, the amendment is permissive. I guess what makes us nervous is that there are some administrative issues that we've identified that. We think it would be necessary to implement this. There would need to be some signaling through the online billing system, you know, on a claim by claim basis. It gets down to what does notice mean? We would be only buying the branded product at that point in the marketplace for the fee for service Medicaid clients. We wouldn't be buying it to dispense to other. People insured by other payers, because those payers don't have access to the same rebate arrangements that the Medicaid program has, as Medicaid gets best price. So we would have the overwhelming number of the patients our pharmacy serves will be getting the generics. We'd be buying a product just for them. We would need to have enough advance notice to continue to buy the product. We would also need some advance notice that, you know, the window is closing, it's no longer going to be the department's advantage, and give us time to clear it out of our systems. There are a number of layers to this. We don't think they're insurmountable, but we would like the flexibility to be able to, you know, work with the department rather than any kind of a mandate. And I think we should be very careful about what we expect out of this. There may not be much here.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair. So I just want to understand the department. Are you saying, Ms. Reed, that you do not anticipate a fiscal impact to this concept that Mr. Costin is advancing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, I don't actually know whether or not there would be a fiscal associated with it. In some ways, the budget note would directive to study the issue would allow us to identify whether or not there is ultimately a fiscal, because it's those administrative issues that we need to address, and some of which Mr. Holt has talked about. And until we engage with the stakeholders, I don't know what that cost is going to be. There could be an some administrative cost for implementing this. Then the question would be in our minds whether or not the overall savings from the drugs would offset the administrative cost. That would be a consideration.
Okay. May I follow up? And then, thank you, Mr. Chair. Then my question to Mr. Holt is, can you sort of make your record on the record here in such a way that would alleviate some of your concerns?
Chair Morissette, Representative Dalto, I think the key issues for us are that we would want some very clear assurance from the department. We'd be a whole lot more comfortable if it were in language, but we don't have that opportunity at this hour. We'd want some clear assurance that there would be advance notice to the pharmacies, and very clear notice that there would be a product to be preferred as a brand. We would need to be sure that the department can in fact use the online billing system to signal on each claim, as we have a general prohibition on prior authorization, so we wouldn't be able to use that tool that we would normally use in a situation like this in a private pay situation. And I think the biggest issue is the potential for audit findings. And we really want an absolute assurance that this is not something that's going to come back and hit us as we try to work with the department. The auditors, tend, in our experience, to be fairly technical in their approach to audit findings. And those audits can be very expensive to the pharmacies, even when they've really done nothing wrong.
Okay, now...
Those are some of the obvious issues to us. And again, we're just seeing this language. So
okay. So we have some choices. We have a budget note. We could go with the budget note. We have a bill. We could expedite the process by the bill. We may need clarification of the bill. There may be a need to. Okay, first of all, is it worth moving on the bill? And I'd like to have a discussion. We might ask for a recess and do some clarification language if that's what we need. Are we happy with the budget note, or do we need a bill? Senator Cruz.
Well, thank you. I understand Tom's concerns, and you know, that sort of, pardon the term, minutia is usually left to rule, not statute. And I understand your concerns, and I understand you want some safeguards against the mean, cruel, evil auditors, and I understand that. I guess the way I look at it, with the budget note, which is in both the House and Senate versions, that budget note's there, so that budget note does survive regardless of what happens here, and it calls for the study, and I think that's appropriate. I guess what I'm looking at, this language, it allows implementation whenever the study shows that there's savings to be made. And so I don't see the two as conflicting necessarily with each other. And I think the work group should be able, because you will probably be on that work group, so you should be able to address the concerns, of the administration and the various safeguards through that process. I mean, just because Section 10 sub 8 is in here doesn't mean that it happens tomorrow. It happens when it happens, but I guess, ultimately we're trying to do everything we can to save money wherever we can. This isn't the silver bullet we were looking for, because guess what, it doesn't exist. But this does have the potential of allowing the department to save some money on purchase of drugs. I think it's a tool, and that's all it is. And I understand Tom's concerns, but, with the combination of this amendment and the budget note, I think you have the venue to address those. So that's, Mr. Chair, that's my opinion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I like to look at this as, yes, maybe the drug costs less, but the administrative costs are going to be maybe a whole lot higher, and we don't know that yet. So even though you might be saving money on the actual cost of the drug, the administrative costs might be higher, and I think that's why we wanted to go with a study to see what would actually be involved. Having worked as a provider with these, the minutiae, the details could actually cost us more. And I think that's where we want to be careful, and that's why I would be more in favor of working these out to make sure it's not going to be costing the department more money. So that's okay. Sort of where I'm coming from.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we need to not lose sight of the fact that the budget note will go on for a full biennium. In that process, of the budget note study, which while it's ongoing, I think it's contemplated that the department may make findings and then may then pay for a particular brand name after the proper notification. And that's that doesn't preclude the study from continuing to ongo, but it also indicates that, goodness sakes, if you realize you hit the iceberg, there's no reason to go out and try and rearrange the deck chairs at that point. Let's go ahead with the making the findings, and this allows that, so that they can then continue while that continues to be ongoing, that after the findings are made, then a particular brand name, after notification of the pharmacies, can be made at that price. So I think that while both items are
Well, both items are valid. Both items can still stand, in my way of looking at it.
Are you advocating for the amendment?
I am advocating at that point, Mr. Chair, for the amendment in, on page 5.
Okay. Representative Dahl, do we need to take a recess to... Let's talk about the amendment as opposed to the budget note. Do we want to go with the amendment as opposed to the budget note? It's a question.
Mr. Chair, the budget note already exists. It's already in the budget.
It exists. Do we need the amendment then?
Well,
is it desirable to have the amendment?
Well, if you're listening, mm-hmm. that's what I said, and that's what Representative Butler said. But maybe we need to stand at ease for 5 minutes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I guess I have a concern that we're struggling with a bill that has several amendments to it, and suddenly 5 minutes, an hour before we we have a brand new thing that is, I don't know that it's necessary, is my feeling. My feeling is that the budget note allows this to happen. I'm not opposed to the amendment if we can get it done expeditiously, and if the majority of this committee favors the amendment, then I don't have a problem with it, but I don't want to have them mess around with something new before we...
Mr. Chair, the budget note allows it to be studied. The amendment allows it to happen.
Well, I would think that if it is studied and if it's advantageous, it will happen.
So did you ask me for my opinion? My opinion is, I think you're right, Mr. Chairman. We can take a brief at ease and allow Mr. Holt and Mr. Kosasin and Ms. Reed to sit down with the Legislative Council and see if we can maybe clarify Mr. Holt's concern.
Can we get Holly up here?
Holly, would you please come forward?
If I can send a message, because I locked myself out of the office coming down here.
Oh, you can't get back in your office?
Not at the moment.
To do any work. Okay.
I can get you a rock without help.
Okay. The question is, what needs to be done to, if anything, what needs to be...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Holly Robinson, Legislative Council. First of all, I just want to clarify something. Should the department choose to do something like this, it would be necessary for somebody to come back to this assembly and change the statute. The key words in this currently are notwithstanding subsection 3 of this section. So in order to go forward and actually implement this idea of the biennium, the amendments would be necessary. There would be a law change necessary. So, in fact, all the budget note is doing is to say come back and study that. So that's the first issue I wanted, given the misunderstanding. I think the concerns that Mr. Holt has expressed, whereas legitimate, are not something that the statute can really address. I really see them as issues because of the permissive language in the because of his concern, because of the permissive language of the statute, because of the notification requirement that's on the department to notify pharmacies, mm-hmm. I think that as far as the statute goes, it provides those protections. I think anything else would almost have to come by administrative rule to comply with those things. The department, and the rules are going to be so cumbersome that I'm not sure that they can be drafted currently. And as Mr. Holt knows, one can monitor administrative rule processes to also make sure that the rules comply. But the intent of this was to put an affirmative duty on the department to notify the pharmacy so they would not be in the position of dispensing a brand name instead of a generic without having the green light, so to speak, from the department, therefore giving them trying to address his concerns about at least legal concerns about whether or not they are violating the law and whether or not reimbursement will occur. I think the rest of the issues are practice issues that are probably better addressed in the administrative rule process or in the provider guide process that the department relies heavily on. And as I said, based on my conversations, because there is an affirmative duty by the department, and the record should reflect this, to notify a pharmacy before they would do this. As far as the statute is concerned, I don't know what else one could put in here that would go further to allay those concerns. I would be willing to figure out if it could, other than a four-page administrative rule. I'd be happy to do it, but I think the burden on the department is high enough, and there is a may in there that... from a legal standpoint, I think that that concern is addressed.
Okay. So you think the may allows the flexibility?
Mr. Chair, I believe the may allows the flexibility, and I think that the affirmative duty is on the department to notify a pharmacy that, in fact, they may under this circumstance, dispense a brand.
Okay.
So you sort of have two gates by which one can...
Now,
run through. That's an interesting analogy.
Yeah, Ms. Reed, do you administrative rules? Then do you, if we pass this amendment as part of the statute, then necessary administrative rules would be then made.
Mr. Chair, certainly the first thing we would do would be to convene the work group to identify the issues.
Okay.
Following that, if the decision is that it makes sense to move forward, we would certainly go through the administrative rule process.
That clarifies. Very good. Thank you.
If I could just add one thing. Because... this, if we did go down this road, we would be carrying a product that has increased cost to the pharmacy. It's a basic. There's that risk there being stuck with essentially a product that we can't dispense to other payers. It would be helpful, I think, to us to have on the record that while the statute would say there'd be a prospective notice to the pharmacy, that the department would be agreeable to notifying us before there would be an end to that requirement so that we had time to clear it out of our system. So we could anticipate that, here we are, say, beginning of July, that the department would notify us, by the end of this month, we're going to be phasing out the preference for dispensing a brand in the fee-for-service Medicaid, so we would know not to reorder that product as we got toward the end. Otherwise, we're potentially stuck with the cost.
Okay, well, and those are the issues that the work group would address, I'm assuming, but you confuse me a little bit, Tom. If a Medicaid drug, Legend drug, goes generic, does that mean that nobody else in the world is going to buy the brand drug?
Chair Moore said, Senator Cruz, essentially in the private pay world, the private third-party payers, as a general rule, require pharmacies to dispense only the generic ones that becomes available because, in general terms, it is almost always cheaper to the payer to pay for the generic, just as it's cheaper for the pharmacy to acquire it at the pharmacy's acquisition cost. What we're talking about here is what happens net of rebates during a very short window of time.
Yeah. But basically, Tom, I think you're putting on record a concern that I think the work group's going to need to address.
Chair Morris, Senator Cruz, correct, and it would make us very much more comfortable if the department could also note that.
Okay.
Can we ask the department to note that?
Mr. Chair. It's on the record.
Say so noted.
Mr.
So
Chair, noted. Members of the committee, it's so noted.
Okay. Now, at this point, we need a clarification of Mr. Committee Administrator.
Just in terms of which amendments do what, and if the committee so decides to adopt the pharmacy provision along with the original provision of 782, the 0-10% exemption, and the basically 6-month grace period modified language, that would be the -B9 amendments. That is incorporated in the -B9s.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, damage.
I have a question. You know, when you get amendment just an hour before we're passing, I'd spent a lot of time looking at the B7s and understanding that. If we're going to go with the B9s, I can't vote for... in concept, I think it's all right, but I am not comfortable moving it out until I have a little bit more time to... if we could... come back in tomorrow. I just can't go with the B9s. I'm not saying that I wouldn't vote for it after I do a little bit more sleuthing. I'm ready to do pass the B7s right today. Maybe by tomorrow I would be more amenable to the B9s, but not today.
Other comments?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, is staff telling us there is any difference at all between the... I thought the staff's position was that the only difference between the B7 and the B9 is included on page 5 on the subparagraph A.
The dash B7s and the dash B8s, the only difference between those two is the dash B7s include exempting 0 to 10%. Mm-hmm. Dash B8s take that 0 to 10% out. The dash B9, the next version,
is the B7 with pharmacy. The pharmacy.
Yes.
And
sorry,
so Representative or Senator Moss Anderson indicated that she was comfortable with the B7s, having researched those laid out side by side. The B7 and the B9 is identical in the change language, with the exception of that portion on page 5 is what you have told us, and just my quick review of it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
Also, I think the thing that satisfies me with this, because I am also somewhat reluctant, or was reluctant with the B9s, was that there will be a work group to do administrative rules. There will be a work group, just as if it were a budget. Now, we could go with the budget notes. That's the thing that I... Well, we've had this discussion. Yeah. But okay. We're going to do the... Do we have a motion for the B9?
Mr. Chair, the Senate... I move the Senate recede from the House amendments dated June 27, 2005, and the bill be further amended with the dash B9 amendment dated July 12, 2005, and be repassed.
Okay, it's been moved. That the Senate recede from the House amendments dated June 27, 2005, and that the bill be further amended with the dash B9 amendment dated January 12th, okay, and be recast. It's a Senate bill, okay. Would the clerk, discussion, further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will be a no, just because I am very comfortable with... I usually always go to my pharmacy people. Mm-hmm. And this may be okay, but I am very reluctant to go with the B9s until I have, okay. more time.
That's understood. Mr. Chair,
yes.
I still question whether this 10% thing is going down the wrong track. I truly, truly do, but I can also see where this train is going. So, so I will watch and see what happens, but I will support it at this point.
At this point. Okay. Other comments? Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Representative Dalto.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Moss Anderson.
No.
Chair Morrison.
Aye. Senate Bill, okay, the amendment has passed, Senate B9, Senate Bill 782, B9 amendments has passed, and who would like to carry on the House side?
Oh, on the House side.
Carrier?
Stolto.
Stolto, okay, and I will carry on the Senate.
Yes, you will.
Yes, I will. You're going to do a minority report?
Ooh, you can't have a conference committee, that's really unfortunate.
Darn!
And Senator Morris Anderson never joined me on a minority report.
Oh, okay. The work session is closed, the meeting is adjourned.
Please only be free.